Yeah.
Right.
Examinations, and was often consulted about PhD candidates as to their scholarship and merit, and was gradually accepted as a member of the a regular member of the faculty.
Okay, now
where do we go from here?
Now, okay, what else? There was nothing else lost on the tape except I asked you about public school.
Oh, yes, you asked me about
I asked you what school, what was happening to your daughter.
Yeah, my daughter was entered into the Lincoln School, which was an experimental school of the Teachers College with an exceptionally progressive faculty, since we had explored the situation in the public schools and found it totally unsatisfactory, she entered as a pre-kindergarten pupil and went straight through high school.
And you didn't feel bad about not sending her to public school with
Well, the attitude of the time was one in which the children we would want the children to mingle with the masses, but there were so many opportunities for her to do that through the local meetings, especially when she got old, when she was older, when she was in high school. She would attend American Labor Party meetings, and she would meet young people of her own age, adolescents who were engaged in the same political activity as she would have liked. She had plenty of contact. She did not. She was not lacking in that. So we felt that her education was a priority.
Okay. Now, do you think? Oh, the unemployment councils we haven't talked about.
Yes. I can't give you very much on the unemployment councils, except that I did attend the big demonstration in 1933, and at this time the unemployment councils were very active, and there was an enormous march on Washington for unemployment insurance, Social Security, and for other demands that the unemployed were making at the time. The march to Washington started actually as we in the city of Washington itself. Many, of course, came cars on by trains from all over the country, but the actual march was organized at the railroad station practically, and then we marched up into the city. And as we marched into the city, the leaders of the march informed us that we had been assigned a certain area where we would camp for the night, and it was going to be a real encampment. It was rather chilly. It was in March. But the enthusiasm of the people was very great.
Who did you go with? What group did you go with?
I went with the New York Unemployment Councils. And I went along with the Unemployment Councils to report on what was happening. I was a reporter. I was not a participant in the other sense.
Uh-huh.
And as a reporter for the Rank and File Federationist, I think we wanted to have a story on it, a direct story on it. I had opportunities that some of the other marches didn't have. In fact, I was constantly in touch with the leadership of the march, and these were the people at the head of the unemployment councils, and some of the party leaders were there too. There were several women in this group who were leaders. And
you remember any other names?
Yes, I do. One was Anna Damon, who was Ruthenberg's widow.
Oh.
And there were others, I don't remember particularly, except that Anna Damon really took charge of the women. And at night, instead of staying out all night as the men did, the women were sheltered at a Salvation Army station, which was clean enough, but absolutely bare and barren. And that I remember that the night that I stayed with the women all night, we spent most of the night talking about the unemployment councils and about the political situation generally. And I got quite a bit of information from Anna Damon about what their plans were. There was an enormous response from the people in the city. They sent food to us. There was sympathy, general sympathy, and the marches were very stoic, very, very strong. But as you know, the march had to come to an end. We didn't want to have a repetition of the Anacostia Flats thing, where, in which they opened fire on the veterans. So we sent a delegation to the Congress, I think.
Uh-huh.
And the delegations went to see our congressmen and other congressmen from various cities and countries. And then after that was over, we dispersed.
And was the Communist Party the leader of the march?
Well, the Communist Party, there were Communist Party leaders in every unemployment council throughout the country. So that it was actually the leadership of the council itself was really a communist leadership, but there were many non-communists within the councils, and many joined the ranks who were unemployed and who felt that something had to be done by the government to alleviate the unemployment situation. So it was really a big united front organization, and it was quite influential in Congress and elsewhere. Even though we were hated and we were called Reds and so on, and they tried to, to denigrate the movement as much as possible in the press, nevertheless, it was influential. And that's the only contact I had with the unemployment councils mm-hmm. as a reporter. And then, of course, I wrote a story on it when I got back.
Uh-huh. Anything else about the 30s?
Yes. There were two other things. One was our second visit to the Soviet Union, which occurred on the eve of World War II. And
this was 1941 or
no, it was 1948.
Oh.
It was
the
last year.
Valentine.
Yes. It was the very last year before anyone could travel anymore. I have mentioned earlier that my husband did the microfilms of the Lewis Henry Morgan materials,
right.
And these microfilms had been sent to the Soviet Union earlier, and were paid for by the Russian embassy, partly in cash and partly in rubles, so that we had rubles when we got to Leningrad. Our trip once again was for I think 4 or 5 weeks. During which time, I sent our our little girl to a girls' camp, she went with the daughter of one of our friends in the neighborhood here, who was very devoted to her and to us, the Waldens, and they watched over her and sent us regular reports.
Uh-huh.
When we got to Leningrad, there was 5,000 rubles waiting for us in the bank. It was quite easy. It was no problem at all. And with that money, we were able to travel all through the Soviet Union, all the way to Erevan in Armenia, Soviet Armenia, which was a fascinating experience for us. We at the same time, were leaders of a group. We didn't go by ourselves. Mm-hmm. We led a group of teachers, social workers. The group altogether were 12 to begin with by the time we
Who
left.
Who organized the group?
The group was organized by the Compass Travel Bureau, which was an independent travel bureau. Because we were able to get our expenses paid, we didn't have to pay for the actual trip. We thought it would be a good way of going, and it meant that practically every session on the ship, we went by ship, every session on the ship was devoted to lectures and discussions of various aspects of Soviet life.
Mm-hmm.
So I gave one on Soviet women, and my husband, of course, spoke about what the Soviets were doing as far as the minorities were concerned,
mm-hmm.
and he discussed a number of other aspects of Soviet life, which was fascinating. And we had a very intelligent, very fine group of young people. Some of them were going as graduation presents after they had left college. Oh. Their parents wanted them to be with us, and they felt safe in sending their young children with us. So we had several 18 or 19 year olders, and then we had a number of older people.
You didn't think of bringing your daughter?
Well, she was only six.
Yeah.
I think it was 37. Mm-hmm. She was born in 31. Yes, it was 37. She was only 6 years old, and we thought that she wouldn't get very much out of it. It would be very tiring for her and for us, too. So that trip was quite fascinating. But there, we failed to see the people we had met earlier, mm-hmm. because none of them wanted to see us. There was such a restrictive atmosphere in the country. The Soviet government had discouraged people from seeing foreigners. And I had brought a gift from a very dear friend in New York to her sister. And it took me a week to locate her sister. And when her sister came, she accepted the gift and said, "I'm sorry, but I can't stop to talk to you."
Mm-hmm.
The fear of meeting foreigners or having anything to do with foreigners was so...
With
Americans particularly, but foreigners in general, uh-huh. they were so great that they really treated us as they hazed us in a sense.
Uh-huh.
You know, they treated us as foreigners and not as tourists. Result was that some of the academicians that we had hoped to see were either out of town or on vacation, or there was some excuse given. We could not get into the Academy of Sciences. That was closed. And we couldn't locate the films anywhere, the Morgan microfilms that we had sent them. And no one seemed to know anything about the microfilms. And, of course, our group was disappointed because one of the announcements that had been made to the group was that they would meet some of the scientists at the academy, which we had planned to... we had planned to have a lecture at the academy and perhaps have one of the scientists speak to us, but we couldn't achieve that.
And you had made contacts there before? You said on this trip you had made contacts with other... You would use some party connections to make contacts.
Yes, on this trip I had letters from... I had a letter from Jack Satchel to the trade mm-hmm. union officials, and I made contact with them, and they told me quite a bit about what was happening at the time in the trade union movement. I think perhaps I went visit some factories. My memory is rather dim uh-huh. on that.
And did you look into the situation of women at all? Or?
No.
Uh-huh.
We had some women in our delegation, and they asked some very pertinent questions, and there was discussion about the developments among women. Most of the group were disappointed that there weren't more women officials in the hierarchy of the Soviet Union.
They had just gotten rid of abortion. That was a very bad time for women.
Yes, it was. It wasn't a good time. As a matter of fact, it was just on the eve of the Tukhachevsky execution,
uh-huh.
when General Tukhachevsky was charged with being a German spy and had been executed. And there was great tension in the country. There was great fears. However, the food situation was much improved from the earlier visit, and there was more food generally. And some of the Americans whom we knew, who were in Moscow, were very helpful to us. We saw a lot of the city, and they told us a great deal. But the interesting thing is that they did not tell us about the purges,
uh-huh.
and nobody seemed to be aware of the purges. Since then, I have talked with some of the journalists, American journalists, who were covering the Russian news for the Daily Worker, who tell me on their word of honor that they did not know that the purges were taking place.
Did you look anyone up who had disappeared or mysteriously?
We couldn't find them. We tried to find them. Yes, we tried to find them, and it was our own feeling that they may have disappeared, but we could not pin it down. There was no way of knowing. All we were told was that some of the academicians that we expected to see, and we had been in correspondence with them and they expected to see us, were not available mm-hmm. anymore because they were on vacation or they had...
And what did you think was going on?
We didn't really know, and we were so absorbed in what in seeing things that we weren't really ready to suspect anything. We were absolutely unaware of the fact that there were concentration camps. Mm-hmm. There was no way of knowing that. There were no, you know, labor camps
right.
for prisoners. There was no way of knowing that there were tremendous trials going on.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, two of the journalists that I have met since gave me their word of honor that they had, did not, at the time when we were there, did not know. They were reporting news to the Daily Worker in New York and did not know that there were purges going on. It was very well kept.
But the general climate was.
But the general climate was quite quite fearful. There was fear in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, we saw a lot of the Soviet Union in places we hadn't been to before.
Oh, you saw some national minority areas?
And, well, we went to Erevan,
yeah.
which is, and that was still quite primitive, but
uh-huh.
they were beginning to build side by side with the mud huts, the, mm-hmm. The high-rise apartments. And the people were very friendly and very happy, and we had really a very gay time all the time.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, we had a gay time even in Moscow and in other cities that we went to. We went to the Urals. We were in the we were in Rostov. We were in Rostov on the Don.
Yeah.
We were in Odessa. We were in many, many places because we had these 5,000 rubles. Travel with
and
them. You
did
see.
You have to travel with the students that you brought?
Well,
or?
Some when we went to Erevan, we didn't travel with
uh-huh.
them. We left them behind and met them on our way back. But most of the time, we had a regular tour with
uh-huh.
them. And then we would we went on our own and came back
uh-huh.
and joined them, and they came back with us. Now, on our return trip from the Soviet Union, we stopped in Vienna
uh-huh.
to get trained
mm-hmm.
trains to Le Havre, where our boat was leaving. And in Vienna, we had the first taste of what Nazism was doing to the Jews. There we saw rabbis with beards, Jews with beards, sweeping streets, because of our name, they had confined us to a Jewish hotel. The agency that made the bookings confined us to a Jewish hotel, although the bulk of our delegation were non-Jews. And it was a good experience for them because they saw what it meant to be segregated. And of course, there was a great deal of lying about the Soviet Union among the Jews in the hotel, who said that they were sure that Jews were being killed all the time. And Zionist press in Switzerland, which was read in Vienna, had headlines about how thousands of people were dying on the streets of Kiev, that there were bodies were lying there, and they had pictures that they manufactured. So, of course, when we told them that we had just come from Kiev, that we had seen Kiev with our own eyes, and that there were no dead bodies on the streets, and that we did not see people starving to death, they wouldn't believe us. The Jews wouldn't believe us. And they simply said that we just hadn't seen what... We only saw what they wanted us to see, which was not true, because we wandered through the streets of Kiev, and,
uh-huh.
we saw everything that we could see. But certainly we didn't see starving babies on the streets as these headlines pointed out. The Jews were very unreceptive to anything from the Soviet Union, and they were just waiting to be transportation to what was in Palestine, not Israel
mm-hmm.
yet. And they were waiting for transportation. That's all that was interested them, and they had absolute contempt and hatred for anything that had to do with the Soviet Union. So
you didn't meet communists, though.
Well, the Austrian communists were underground
right.
because they had had
oh,
they had
the
had,
uprising.
Yeah, they had the uprising.
Right.
But we had a very curious incident on the way home. We got on the train for Le Havre, and on the train, we met one of the professors at Columbia University, Dr. Lazarsfeld, who was an Austrian and who had come to the United States early in the 30s. And he had gone back to Austria to rescue his wife. I'm not sure that whether he was already divorced from her, but anyway, she was his wife. And child. He had a child who was a year older than my daughter, 7. The child was, the mother and child were on the train with him, and they were going to Le Havre.
He's Jewish?
I think he is, yes. They were going to Le Havre to get the same boat that we were getting. But on the way, I got to know his wife, and she told me that she was not going with him. She was going back to the underground, that she wanted to continue to fight underground as long as she could. She was a dedicated socialist. His daughter was left alone, and she was very, very unhappy and cried a great deal. And since I was missing my child, and the father was quite upset, he hadn't seen her for a long time, he wasn't very close to her, I spent a lot of time with this child on the boat and enjoyed very much having her as my as my little
surrogate.
Surrogate daughter. Later, the mother came over, used her maiden name, and I think became had a professorship at NYU. She was a psychology professor. I never met her again. I never saw her after that time. But I assumed that it was impossible for her to do any more work because she didn't. She evidently did come out of. She was able to get out of the country in time, but I think she was also Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
But that, of course, was the beginning of the, Hitler had not yet. Hitler had not yet entered Austria. It was still under Dollfuss. Yes,
right.
But soon afterwards he entered. So that was a very distressing and unpleasant experience in Austria itself. Fortunately, we only had to stay 2 days because we were waiting for that transportation. And I saw very little of Vienna at that time. There was another episode that I wanted to talk about. Came back to the United States.
Another episode on the trip or some other part of your life at that period?
Another part of my life, but I don't know what it is.
Okay, we're continuing.
Yes, I didn't have, we didn't have very much sociability. Whatever friendships were made largely through meetings and joint activities, participating in various activities together, and that constituted our social life, actually. I think that this had some effect on my child, who was, because of are being so busy, didn't have the opportunities that other children had of having parties of children at her home or going to other children's homes. And I always felt that I had deprived her, in a sense.
Was she close to your mother?
She was very close to her grandmother, yes. So my mother was not yet living with us permanently. She was still in Boston with my father, but she was coming back and forth frequently. And she usually stayed 2 or 3 months when she came. So that my daughter was always in touch with her. There was always someone home when she came home, you see. And, of course, the grandmother filled the vacancy that I had left. But I always chastised myself about that. I never felt that
but
I had...
But you continued working.
But I continued working because that was my life.
Right.
So my social life and my party life were really sort of merged, in a sense. And yet I had very little sociability with party leaders. Or
and Bernard joined the party because of anti-fascism when you came?
Yes, he joined rather late, I think, around the time of the Spanish War, and he left in 43.
Mm-hmm.
So, during this time, he was not at all connected with anything at Columbia. There was a separate group with which he met and had nothing, otherwise he would have been caught up in that terrible Elizabeth Bentley thing, you remember?
Oh, yes.
But
mm-hmm.
fortunately, he met with a group of writers, and they really didn't do very much of party work. They did mostly anti-fascist work among
or
other
no
writers.
Mass work.
No mass work at all. It was mostly a writers' group that was concerned with the kind of writing that should be done for to propagandize against anti-fascism. It was really not a terribly important group in relation to the developments in the world outside, but it gave them some feeling of belonging, you see, the writers who were involved, and none of the writers were activists. the apostles.
These were people around masses, or?
No, they were writers mostly. Uh-huh. They were either playwrights or...
Like Mike Gold?
Well, he wasn't a part of that. These were mostly people who were, not all of them
like
were known
Joseph
writers.
Freeman?
But he was not a member of that group either. By this time, by the end of the 30s, you know, Joseph Freeman had already left the party. Yeah. And then, of course, Granville Hicks. The Munich Pact was the breaking point. That was when all of the writers that they had gathered together in this group, not all of them, but many of them, decided that they couldn't go along with the Nazis.
How did that affect
the Nazis?
You and Bernard, the Hitler-Stalin Pact?
Well, I think he was very clear about that, and we were both very clear about the fact that that Stalin was buying time.
Uh-huh. And you understood it.
Yeah, but it did have some impact on the students. Because they came to him to get an explanation, and when he supported Stalin's position, many of them became very disillusioned and were very angry with him, and he lost a great many students, too. Mm. But during this period also, the FBI had him under surveillance, and later on in the 40s, it's obvious that there were actually some implants in the classes. Agents who attended his classes.
Didn't that affect your United Front work also, the Hitler-Stalin Pact?
Well, it may have in certain areas, but it mostly affected intellectuals. The working class didn't feel affected by it at all, especially when the party explained that it was biding time. And of course, in the unions, the Soviet Union itself was not such an important factor. Even in the organizing, in the embryonic unions, the party was not a factor so much.
Right.
The people knew that we were left. The workers who came to us saw that we were dedicated, that we were committed to organization. But party activity and party life was not very much of a part of
the thing. Is that since you saw fascism in Europe, didn't you think that we should enter the war and help against the fight against fascism? And here the communists were preaching peace at that time?
No, not after the Nazi-Soviet pact they weren't preaching peace. They were preaching peace in the early part when the country, the whole, during the NRA period and the early Roosevelt period. But after Hitler began his march into Europe and so on, the party policy changed. And then we were supporting a war.
You were supporting America's efforts to win the war?
Well, no, we weren't supporting American efforts, but we were supporting the war.
Buying time?
Yeah, even though we were supporting... See, originally the party interpreted this as an imperialist war. And
right, and they were for peace.
And they changed their mind. But when it is clear that the whole trend would be against the Soviet Union, then the party changed, and obviously they would have changed.
Well, they didn't change because of fascism then. That's what all I'm saying. I'm just saying that it doesn't appear that the party changed because of the fascist menace. They changed because of the menace to the Soviet Union.
I think that's fairly correct.
And
yeah.
You, as anti-fascist, didn't feel that as a conflict. That's all I meant.
Well, we did feel the anti-fascist. You see, we had this League Against War and Fascism, and the League Against War was the pacifist side, you know, the fact that we wanted to keep the peace. But later, in the 30s, it was evident that there would be a war.
Well, didn't you know about concentration camps at this time?
No, we didn't know anything about them at all.
But didn't you see Jews being...
Well, I wasn't speaking. I'm talking of the Russian.
No,
labor camps.
I meant the labor camps of the Nazis.
Oh, well, yes, we were reading about how the Jews were being sent.
Right.
But you see, the Holocaust itself didn't develop until after 1938. He was biding his time. He was feeling things out.
Uh-huh.
Hitler, and it was by that time, 1938 and 1939. That we began to urge cooperation in the war and help to the war.
Russian aid relief.
Russian war relief and so
right.
on. Yeah, that started around 39 or 40. And, of course, when Hitler started marching into Europe and all of the communists were being arrested and being destroyed, you see, then, of course, it was obvious that we had to get in. But I don't think it was really, we were really not, we were anti-war until pretty late in the 30s. And of course that was following the policy of the party.
Right.
However, once we got into the war, then of course the party threw itself into anti-war work, tremendous, not anti-war work, but anti-Hitler, anti-fascist mm-hmm. work with everything it had. But there was that period of on the fence.
Uh-huh.
Of course, you must also remember that the Spanish Civil War intervened, and the party did organize, help organize the Lincoln Brigades, so that the party wasn't an anti-war party
right.
at all.
No.
We were anti-fascist, you see, and the struggle against fascism continued all along, but
uh-huh.
I don't think that the awareness of Hitler's threat
right.
became so obvious Hitler began to march, when
mm-hmm.
he began to march into France, into Belgium, and, you know, into all of Western European countries, then we became alarmed.
Now, what did you do when you came back from Austria? What were you doing then when you came back?
Oh, that was in 1938, and that was when, right after that, I went to work with the UOPW, United Office of Professional Workers Union, and became the educational director. And I served as such until 1940.
Right.
And then they had no funds, and they were not able to keep their forces together, and they declined into small local groups, and the national office practically closed its doors. So then just at the time of Pearl Harbor, the Food Workers Union, the Hotel and Club Employees Union, who were now 30,000 strong, they had gotten contracts for all the hotels in the city, and it was practically a closed shop by that time. They asked me to come in as educational and welfare director. In other words, I handled the welfare problems, unemployment compensation, the problems that workers had with all kinds of other personal things, and their tax situation, everything.
Your social work and your labor together.
That's right. It was a social work-labor combination. And then I also organized classes. And then we had...
What classes for what? For the food?
On trade unionism, on what is a union and how a union functions, and what was the structure of the AFL and the structure of the CIO and what the role of a local union was within the Central Labor Council. I got out several pamphlets and, you know, small brochures.
And what did you think of the CIO and the whole Lewis, when it started? Did you have any role in that?
Well, sure, certainly.
Yeah.
But you see, the unions that I was associated with were all offshoots of the American Federation of Labor, and it was the Trade Union Unity League policy to unite rather than to divide.
Right.
So wherever there was a group that belonged normally to an AFL group, we urged them to join that group. So the hairdressers, of course, joined the AFL, much to my dislike, and but the UOPWA was CIO.
Oh.
And they remained within the CIO
mm-hmm.
until they really...
Did you feel close to the CIO?
Yes, I did, especially when I was in the UOPWA. I went to many of the conferences and conventions and state conferences and so on. You know, I was really very deeply involved. And we thought very much of the CIO, but... all the time, Foster was preaching labor unity, and he did not want two unions in the United States. He wanted one, and actually, it was many of the people who were in the CIO who had been influenced by the Trade Union Unity League who advocated the merger of the AFL and CIO later,
uh-huh.
and it resulted in.
You weren't so much encouraging of the split.
Well, we had to organize new. We were organizing new unions all the time,
uh-huh.
and the AFL was unreceptive to unskilled workers, to semi-skilled workers. They wanted to keep the highly skilled workers within their ranks, and they didn't care about the others. In fact, they benefited by the fact that the others were not organized. So that when we did, when the various groups within the Trade Union Unity League were able to organize, such as the auto workers and certain sections, certain other groups that were never in a union before, obviously the only place they could go to was the CIO, mm-hmm. you see. So there were various strikes in textiles, the Passaic strike, and then the Gastonia strike, and so on. Now, these were reorganized groups within the Textile Workers Union, but they went into the United Textile Workers, which was AFL-L.
Right.
You see? So wherever there was an AFL-L union, and we had organized a core of unorganized, previously unorganized uh-huh. workers, we tried to get them to join the existing labor movement, the mainstream of the labor movement. And the CIO unions were primarily unions, except for the United Mine Workers, which had its differences with the AFL-L. They were primarily made up of workers who had never before been in unions.
But at the conference where John L. Lewis walked out, unions followed him. Like the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, unions left the AFL-L to join it.
Right, because these were unions that had an industrial base.
Right.
And they saw that through the CIO it would be possible not only to organize the unorganized, but to expand their own base, you see. And so it was logical for them to leave the AFL-L, which was opposed to industrial unionism. And in the course of this, Lewis and Hillman both saw the advantage of organizing the unorganized.
You never thought of the food workers should join the CIO or
no, the food workers once they became strong in every hotel, were in a sense tied up with the AFL-L. They had to tie up with the AFL-L because there were some existing local unions, very small, uh-huh. in the city, you see, and they didn't want to have dual organizations.
Right.
So for instance,
you really didn't encourage that, just in the unions where they needed an industrial base.
That's right, and where there was no other union for them to go to, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of the Amalgamated of course, that was the
Furriers?
That was the core of the CIO, but even later, now the Furriers are part of the meat cutters, I think now. Meat cutters. They joined an AFL-L union because the fur workers union that was in existence, that was an AFL-L union, was so reactionary. They were made up mostly of gangsters and racketeers. So we kept away from those from that element, and we wanted to go. But the general direction was unity and not dual unionism,
mm-hmm.
you see. Foster preached very, very much against dual unionism.
Uh-huh. But then when it started, they backed it, right? I mean, then when
there was never any dual unionism, actually. The Amalgamated retained its identity as a union, and if they organized the unorganized, those people went into the Amalgamated.
Yeah, but they went into the CIO, not the AFL-L.
That's right, they did,
yeah.
Because they had to build an industrial base.
Right.
But when the time came, and they felt that they were strong enough, then they urged merger. You see.
Right. I was just wondering why the communists didn't encourage more unions to join the CIO.
They did. They encouraged
but to leave the AFL-L and join the CIO. Since the AFL-L was so reactionary, when they split in 1935, wasn't it encouraged that so many unions, like...
Well, the idea of trade union unity was mm-hmm. to get the large mass of unorganized workers into the AFL-L so that they could change the AFL-L from within, you see.
Uh-huh. But once they saw
and
it
we
was
had,
impossible to change it.
Well, we had a very, very energetic union in the AFL-L itself. And, of course, when the big Red Scare came out and the witch hunt, then, of course...
You don't mean in 39.
No, I'm speaking now of the later. But when in 1939, when we organized the Hotel and Club Employees Union, we were an example to the whole AFL-L as to what you could do if you organize the unorganized, you see.
Oh, I see.
And that had its, in itself, created a stimulus to the AFL unions to do some organizing. We didn't want to destroy the AFL unions. We wanted to change them from within if we could, you see. That's why we didn't urge people to come out. We didn't want to break them up. We simply wanted to make them, to improve them, to get forces within them that would change their whole approach. And we did in many unions. We had, we were quite successful. For instance, there was quite a number of textile workers unions that were very left within the United Textile Workers apparatus, you see. And similarly in other unions, printers and so on, they were all AFL, but there were many very left unions within them, very left locals, painters. They were all AFL unions.
People who work within the workers' health care.
Yes, well, these were all AFL unions, but you see, we helped to change the character of those unions in the 30s because of the impetus that was given to organizing the unorganized.
What else did you? How long did you work for the food workers?
Well, when they were still an embryo, I worked with them for 3 years. But then, in 1941, just before Pearl Harbor, I came into a well-established union by this time. You see, during the period when I was with the UOPWA, they had established their unions, they had made their contacts with AFL leaders, and they were not then accepted local unions within the AFL, the international union. So when I came in 1941, this was an established trade union, and I was working with Pay, and as an official of the union, a member of the board who reported to the executive board on the work we were doing and so on. I was accepted then.
Yes, you were an official of the union. Were most of the officials of the union like you, or had any risen from the trade union?
Well, there were, you see, in the process of organizing during the 30s, many of the food workers' organizers were young people who came out of the universities. And many of them,
because of the depression, and they couldn't get other jobs.
They really wanted to organize, to be in the organized labor movement, you see. They came in, there were opportunities for them. Most of them had been unpaid for years and years and years, you know, just got along on a shoestring.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had, of course, some of the old-time Trade Union Unity League people who were the core of the whole thing, who had been organizing from the early 30s. And then there were a number of people whom we got out of the industry itself, you see, when we put up a picket line in front of a hotel, and the workers would join us and say that they weren't going to work or there'd be a strike or something, then out of this would come some of the rank and file workers from the industry itself, and we had to be very careful in our choice to see that we got good, honest, not careerist type workers to work with us. Now, sometimes we chose well, and sometimes we made mistakes.
Mm-hmm. And what exactly did you do for the food workers at this period?
Well, I mentioned before, I was welfare and educational director.
And you saw individuals about welfare cases?
I saw
individuals. Organize their welfare policy?
Yes. First of all, we set up a section of the welfare department for accidents and occupational diseases, so that we could give the workers the benefit of that law.
Mm-hmm.
And I got out a little brochure in which I described the workman's compensation law and what the benefits were and how they should apply and what they had to do. And we hired a lawyer to work with them so the lawyer could represent them at hearings.
Right.
See, so that was one aspect of our welfare work.
So you mainly worked in the office.
No, but I went out to the hotels all the time. I used to organize meetings of the workers, for example,
in
the hotels. Yes.
I give a week's type variation of work, so I can get the feel of what type
yes.
of things
well,
you did.
Well, for example, I would call the steward, you know, the shop steward, let's say, of the housekeeping department in a specific hotel. And I'd say, look, I'd like you to call the workers together at the most desirable time for you. And there never were any hours. We never had, we could go at night and we could go early in the morning. Time was just not an important problem to any of us. So they would call back and say, well, we're going to get a group together on such and such a day at such and such an hour. And the shop steward would say, what do you want to talk about? And I'd say, well, I'd like to explain to the workers some of the rights that they have under existing laws, so that they're not mishandle, or they don't have the benefits and so on. So I would go there, and then I would meet with a group, say 15, 25 people.
Now you would speak to the workers. Now, was there a time that the workers to talk to you about what they thought were their problems?
Yes, then they would come into the office, you see. And in that case, yes, we had an assistant who was also a social worker. And if they had an individual problem, such as a problem of a divorce or a problem of any kind of health problems and so on, we would suggest the clinics or the places where they could go, where they could get. See, we didn't do any social work ourselves. We were a sort of
a referral.
Yeah. But most of the workers didn't know where to go or what to do in the event of certain crises or emergencies in their families. And they were very, very happy that we had this kind of individual service, and it was really very useful.
Did you have anything for the wives? Because there were women's auxiliaries at this time.
Well, you see, there were so many women working in the industry.
Was it mainly women working?
Oh, there were practically an equal number. You see, the waitresses were women.